This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte.
Today's word on the future, together. Because the future of business isn't driven by what machines or people do alone, but by all they can achieve together. See how we can help at deloitte.com/us/innovate.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2012, a man named Claudio Rojas was taken from his home in Florida by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Now, that was hardly unusual. He was one of more than 400,000 people detained that year. But what happened next was out of the ordinary, to say the least. Rojas's son contacted the National Immigrant Youth Alliance for help with his father's case. And two young activists with that group went on an undercover mission to infiltrate the Broward Transitional Center where Rojas was being held. They pretended to be newly arrived, undocumented immigrants barely speaking English, and they got themselves arrested by ICE, deliberately. They wanted to find out exactly what was going on at the center and report it out to the world. And Rojas himself was eventually released from detention after leading a hunger strike there. Their story, those activists and Claudio Rojas, is told in a new film called The Infiltrators. Now, it's not exactly a documentary. It's a kind of quasi-documentary, and we'll explain that in a second. It showed recently at the Sundance Film Festival and in Austin at South by Southwest. I talked with the directors Christina Ibarra and Alex Rivera early in the morning after their screening in Austin last week. So, Alex, the two activists are named Viridiana Martinez and Marco Saavedra. These are, in a sense, the two heroes in this film. These are the people that are activists and infiltrate these detention centers. Who are they?
Sure. So Marco and Vidi are both folks that commonly might be referred to as dreamers, meaning they were brought to this country at a very young age. They were both brought from Mexico, Marco from southern Mexico, from Oaxaca, and Vidi from northern Mexico, from Monterrey. And they both ended up, their families ended up finding opportunity and staying in this country. And 20 years later, they're young adults in America, very Americanized, but without papers, without social security numbers. And they turned in their early 20s to activism, realizing that without a social security number, they couldn't get a job. They were living in fear of deportation. So this small group that Marco and Vidi joined said, you know, we're going to take big risks to push for some kind of change. And they were kind of a splinter of this larger dreamer movement. They were the radical fringe, kind of the ACT UP of immigration is maybe one way to sort of think about what they were doing.
The ACT UP of immigration. So an interesting analogy of all the groups, the anti-AIDS groups, ACT UP considered itself the most radical in some ways and the most attention getting. Has this group, the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, succeeded in getting the kind of attention that ACT UP did in its time?
I think so. The National Immigrant Youth Alliance was in this kind of heyday around 2012, and they were really the first group to do civil disobedience from the undocumented community. Again, so risking their deportation as a political protest, using their body not only to make a political statement, but to kind of create a crisis for the authorities.
So they came together and were looking for cases. They worked cases for a couple of years and really learned how to navigate the system. They learned so much about the way the immigration system works. And when they found out about this one particular case at Broward Transitional Center, they saw that there was an opportunity here to do something bigger.
Meaning they essentially make their way into these detention facilities. How did they get access to them, and what was the risk to themselves?
Sure. So for this particular action, they walked up to Border Patrol stations in Florida and essentially presented themselves. They kind of created a dialogue with the Border Patrol agent in which they seemed to accidentally disclose that they had crossed the border illegally and with the hope of being taken in. And, you know, it when they decided they wanted to get taken in by Border Patrol, it actually... they discovered that it was kind of hard to get detained on purpose. And so,
why was that?
Well, because it's completely bizarre. And the Border Patrol officials were like, what is this? Why are you telling me this? Go away. Each of them had to attempt multiple times to get detained, but they were very determined to be detained and to go into this Florida detention center.
What can I do for you?
Hi. I'm looking for my cousin.
Your cousin, why?
We may think he's detained by the Border Patrol.
Is he an illegal alien? Does he have papers to be here?
No, he don't have papers.
Well, did they feel that they had some level of protection?
At that moment in time, I mean, yes, to a degree, because they each had been arrested in a civil disobedience before, sitting in the street, sitting in a politician's office. So they had gone through the system and been released. And so they had kind of done these tests where they believed that maybe because Obama was saying nice things about Dreamers, even though they were getting deported, if they could do these actions in public and get in the news, maybe they could be safe. Maybe they could find some political power. And they had. And so when they turned themselves into Border Patrol at this moment, they had a theory, which was maybe we can get in to a detention center because we're undocumented, but maybe we can get out because we have some power in the media and we can make some noise from inside this detention center. So that was kind of the escape hatch. But there was no DACA, there was no formal protection that they had.
Christina, one of the detainees that you focus on is named Claudio Rojas. And how long had he been in the United States?
So by the time that this story is set, Claudio Rojas has at this point been in the country for about 15 years. He had been in detention for 7 months. He's a father, an Argentinian father with two sons, and has never committed a crime.
Right. And the son contacted National Immigrant Youth Alliance, didn't he?
Right. So Emiliano Rojas contacted the National Immigrant Youth Alliance for support in trying to figure out how to get his father out of detention.
And was he thinking that he would get Marco to go in and help, or was there a simpler motive behind his call?
So Emiliano didn't exactly know what to do. He had already exhausted all of the resources that he knew how. He had tried to get lawyers. So Emiliano kind of had reached the end of his rope. And it was almost like a last resort. You know, he was online. He saw these activists who were willingly exposing their status. And he said, you know, and they were saying, we know how to stop deportations. And so Emiliano reaches out and asks, you know, how can you help me? What can I do? And through this relationship that developed, they slowly started to discover that Claudio was a natural organizer. Claudio was revealing these different cases inside that Nia found were cases that they knew how to work.
So how were Marco and Vitidiana, essentially our heroes in this film, managing to get ICE to release detainees all the same?
So the infiltrators, when they're in there, they're giving information about how to get out, helping people file asylum claims, et cetera, things like that, basic things that can help get people out. So some of the people that they helped release was through that, saying, hey, you suffered violence in your home country, file for asylum. You, this other person, you fit this category, you could apply for bond. You, this other person, you're a dreamer. Let's put political pressure on the administration and get them out. So inside, they were almost like pro bono, you know, lawyers, defenders, educators, translators. Those were the kinds of activities that they were doing inside detention.
Now, as filmmakers, you were faced with an enormous challenge. I have to say, as a viewer of documentaries, I'm not usually wild about recreations in documentaries, although we see it all the time. Here, it's a necessity and you make a virtue of it. You really succeed because you have to film, quote unquote, inside the detention center where you can't get a camera. So tell me how you creatively face this challenge for your film.
You know, the infiltrators themselves are so creative in their tactics and the way that they organize and they work. And one of the things that I saw that really spoke to me was the way that they were taking all of the stories that they learned through this deportation defense work, and they were really learning how to embody them into this role, into a performance. Because when they were trying to get themselves detained, there was this feeling of privilege that they carried themselves. They say they feel like they're, you know, they look and act like a Border Patrol agent might say is a typical American. And so how do you then become someone else? How do you show this vulnerable immigrant? And the way they did that is they studied a role. They prepared the way that an actor prepares.
Alex, how did you go about recreating the Broward Transitional Facility? What did you use instead?
Sure. So we filmed the recreations for the detention center in Southern California in a decommissioned mental facility called Lanterman in Pomona, California. And it's just very big, cold, kind of oppressive institutional setting. And then, but because we were kind of recreating this story and entering into this landscape of script and reproduction, we were able to dialogue with the subjects of the film, the protagonists, as we call them, including Claudio Rojas himself. And so Claudio spent 7 months in the detention center. And so he was on set with us during the filming, working with the art department, working with hair and makeup. He was working with all the different team members to help make a kind of authentic reproduction. And that was something that I think we both as filmmakers really loved, was like kind of getting out of the subject-object relationship that is sort of the core of documentary and journalism, and entering this kind of unknown realm where we were editing a documentary but interweaving a kind of fiction or reproduction into it. And because of that scripting and reproduction process, we were able to dialogue with the folks who lived the story and say, does this look right? What do you think?
Free call from an inmate at Broward Transitional Center. This call is subject to recording at Bolton.
Mohammed, did you know they have solitary in here?
Sure.
You did? And he didn't tell me this?
Why, you scared?
I'm not scared. Of course not. I just didn't know.
Just don't get sent there. And also, we have somebody coming by later. They're going to bring you some paperwork.
Gotta go. My love, Maria.
Okay. Bye.
Now, Christine and Alex, I think any viewer of this film is going to have human sympathy with the detainees. There's no question about it. But some people who are listening to our conversation might be thinking, well, it's awful, it's sad that these people are in this facility, but they broke the law. And what do you say to that?
Sure. I mean, everybody breaks laws every day. Who doesn't speed? Who doesn't? There's tons of laws that get kind of bent and broken all the time. And so we also have a notion in the society that the punishment should equal the crime. And what we have in this reality we're living in now are people being locked up, families, children being locked up for months and years for moving. Not for hurting anyone, not for stabbing anyone, not for stealing from anyone, for moving.
Well, you say moving, but they're not moving from Portland to Seattle. They're crossing a national border, and there are laws about that. What, in your view, what is the politics animating your view of this? What do you think should be the proper policy for this?
Sure. So for me, as an artist, I'm not a politician or a lawmaker. I'm a person interested in the human condition and questions that are ethical and moral. And for me, I know my dad moved to this country. He happened to come with a visa. I have other cousins who came without visas, who are undocumented. But to me, there's something moral about this question of immigration. There needs to be a moral dimension to it. And to me, the moral dimension is that we live in a world in which the rich and powerful can move anywhere they want in the world. But the people who are working class, who have the biggest needs, are meant to be trapped behind walls, like, and kind of manage their movement, managed like kind of like animals or something. So for me, I personally believe in a freedom of movement.
You believe in open borders.
I believe in a freedom of movement. Yeah.
And what's the difference?
Well, for me, it's a linguistic difference, that the freedom of movement highlights the moral core of this question, which is that when people move out of necessity to be with their loved ones, to work, to me, they're expressing their freedom. And I personally, I wouldn't want to lock someone in a cage for doing that.
Now, Christina, Claudio Rojas was recently detained again during a standard check. Is this a normal process?
So Claudio had been going to his regular immigration check-ins for 7 years. And after this film had its Sundance premiere and won awards, and a week before it was to have its Florida premiere, where Claudio was about to attend with his family and his friends from church, he was detained at his regular check-in. Now, what changed between the last time that he checked in and this time? The only difference that we see is that now he's known as someone who speaks out against the abuses inside the detention center. So this is becoming more of a First Amendment battle, where there's this retaliation against him for being an outspoken critic.
We're sort of living inside the film, because the film tells the story of the campaign to get Claudio Rojas out, and we never imagined he'd be back in again exactly when the film is kind of coming out into the world. And we're doing everything that we can with our networks and with the visibility of the film to try to elevate Claudio's case and get him out. We all believe that, you know, all of the 40,000 people in detention right now, the mothers, the children, the fathers, et cetera, we believe they should be free. But we have to start with Claudio. If we can't get Claudio out, then our theory of change and sort of the theory of the movie, you know, doesn't hold.
The film is an important and extraordinary film, The Infiltrators. Alex Rivera and Christina Ibarra, thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Now, we were able to speak with Claudio Rojas, who's being held at the Chrome Service Processing Center in Miami. Rojas has been told that he'll be deported at the end of this month, and he believes it's because of his involvement with The Infiltrators. Here's Rojas with The New Yorker's Camila Osorio.
Hola, Claudio.
Hola, Camila. Mi nombre es Claudio Rojas.
Hi, Camila. This is Claudio Rojas.
Claudio, qué gusto poder hablar. So glad we are able to talk. I'm sorry it has to be under these circumstances.
Pues mira, acá pensando.
We wanted to talk to you because we wanted to know, how have you been this past weeks? How you have felt? What's happened?
Well, since I've been here, I've been sick. I came in healthy, and I've been sick this whole time. So imagine how I feel. I'm not only separated from my family, but I'm here sick. We're in a room that is supposedly for 80 people, but there's 160 people. All the air is contaminated, you know, with viruses, you see. So I caught something in my throat. And when I was in the other detention center, there were 6 of us sharing a room. Here, there's 160 of us sharing one room.
Claudio, we also wanted to ask you, what happened? How were you detained? Can you give us more detail? Was it 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago, I presented myself for a routine check-in, very normal, a supervision visit. I was with my lawyer. We had a petition. My lawyer presented a petition. They made us wait 4 to 5 hours. At one point, suddenly, they opened a door on the side. They called us. They put me in. And they told me, we have the order to detain me. So we were surprised, both me and my lawyer. My lawyer explained we had presented something, but they said, no, that they had to detain me. And there I was in shock. It was a routine check-in visit.
Era una visita rutinaria, eso te iba a preguntar.
A routine visit. I wanted to ask you about that. You had been going to those check-ins for how long? Since you were detained in 2012 and then released. How often did you go to see ICE?
The visits were once a year. But when the administration changed with the new administration that we have, and zero tolerance policy, things have changed a bit. They started scheduling visits every 6 months, and lately they were scheduling them every 3 months. That's how the visits worked. What I'm trying to say is, you know, for 8 years, I presented myself for supervision visits. Why didn't they detain me before? Why are they detaining me just now when we're releasing a movie?
Claro, porque.
Right. Why now? That's what I wanted to ask you. If you think that because of this movie, this is a form of punishment coming from the administration.
Before, I would say, yes, I think so. But now I'm totally sure that this is a form of retribution because they're delaying everything my lawyer presents. They're delaying it or rejecting it. For example, they could give me a stay of removal, which means there would be no deportation until the case we're presenting gets resolved. However, they're not allowing me that. They rejected the stay of removal. And that's why I'm completely sure that this is reprisal against me, that they want to deport me no matter what.
I understand you're going to attend the screening of the movie at a festival in Miami.
I was waiting for that festival. I missed it when it was in Utah because I wasn't given permission to travel to Utah. But I was looking forward to seeing the film here in Miami with my family. So they took that dream away from me, the dream to see the movie with my family. And the biggest dream they're taking from me right now is to be with my grandchildren.
¿Te gustó la película?
Did you like the movie?
I'd like to see it. I still have not seen it. I love the work that was done, but I haven't seen the movie. I want to see it.
Claudia, cuéntanos un poco de los guardias en la película.
So tell us more about the guards. In the movie, their attitude is very aggressive. We wanted to know if the attitude has changed or how is it towards you.
Now, look, at that time, the guards were from the Geo company. Now the company has changed, got a new company. I don't know how to describe the logo. But the attitude of the guards is the same. You know, they're always intimidating people, putting fear into them, like they're saying, we are superior, you are little. Listen, one shouting right now. Between screams and threats. One time an officer came, he was Hispanic, and he treated the detainees badly because he wanted them to be silent. In a space for 80 people, there are 160 people, so the noise is going to double. How can they demand silence?
By any chance, do the guards know of your activism or even the people there are at the detention center?
Well, the people who are here in the detention center, they do know about my activism because they saw me on TV, Channel 51. So when they see me, they know about the movie, the activism, and they come to me with questions.
Claudio, y hablando de preguntas,
an important question.
¿Tienes alguna idea?
Do you have any idea if you're going to get deported at the end of the month or in the coming months?
¿O en los próximos meses?
Eso es lo que están tratando de pelear el abogado, porque...
That's what they're trying to fight with the lawyer, with the judge, to ask immigration why I've been detained. But I haven't heard back, so to extend the date, they said March 30th, that they were not going to take any action against me before that date. So we're holding on to that date, and the lawyers are working fast, but... As I said, they're not working with us at all. They're rejecting every proposal. So I'm very worried that I will get deported on March 30th.
About that, I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about that possibility, about what can happen at the end of the month?
I'm always expecting for a miracle to happen, and something might happen on my behalf. I trust the skills of the lawyers, the organizations that are fighting for me. There's a lot of people involved. In general, I don't like the news, but I have to accept it. As I tell you, I'm a fighter. I fight for what I believe, and I will continue fighting until the end. I'll use all the necessary resources to keep myself in this country.
When you say that, all the resources, do you still consider protest actions like the ones in the movie The Infiltrators?
Exactly.
I guess you cannot tell me which?
No,
I'm going to use actions that maybe I'm not going to tell you over the phone.
Okay. ¿Has estado en comunicación?
Have you communicated with your son, Emiliano, or with the National Immigrant Youth Alliance?
I have to go. They're kicking me out.
Bueno,
I have to go.
Claudio, muchísimas gracias por tu tiempo y cuídate mucho.
Okay, gracias. Muy amable.
Cuídate mucho, Claudio. Hasta luego.
Bye. Claudio Rojas, speaking from ICE detention in Miami with The New Yorker's Camila Osorio, who also translated. A spokesman for ICE told us they couldn't comment on Rojas's case. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You remember the story of Elizabeth Holmes, the young tech billionaire and scam artist? Holmes raised some $400 million for her company Theranos by selling venture capitalists on a revolutionary medical technology that simply didn't exist. HBO is releasing a documentary this month about her extraordinary rise and fall. One thing about Holmes that's always remarked on was that she somehow looked the part, every inch the tech visionary wearing a black turtleneck, very much in the style of the late Steve Jobs, which is, let's just say, a loaded choice to make in Silicon Valley. In the famously casual tech world, it turns out that image matters, and more than you might think.
I'm Rachel Syme, and I am a contributor to The New Yorker who writes the On and Off the Avenue fashion column. The thing that I'm interested in vis-a-vis fashion is there's nothing more fun than figuring out what looks good on your very, very individual, unique body, and then tailoring your style to that, playing, experimenting, and that's not what you're going to see in Silicon Valley. What you're going to see is streamlined and sleek, and yeah, it goes along with the tech thing, right? Everything's about optimization and getting better and constantly refining the algorithm. And I think people are trying to do that with their clothes, too. I did a story earlier this year for The New Yorker on Allbirds, which is the sneaker brand in San Francisco right now. And it is reaching like a crazy valuation. And it's really popular in the Valley because it's this sort of streamlined shoe that costs the same no matter which style you get. And they're all super functional and made of sustainable materials. It's like all these people that are constantly like data mining their life for how can I improve, charting their sleep cycle, and they're doing transcendental meditation, and they're having Soylent for lunch. They want to streamline their life down to the exact number of factors that makes them the bionic human. And that makes me think about Elizabeth Holmes, who founded Theranos. Elizabeth Holmes wore the same thing to work every day: a black turtleneck, black pants, and black flat shoes. And what's interesting about that is, yes, it's an outfit that's optimized, but it's also iconic. She told interviewers that she did it for much of the same reason that Steve Jobs wore a black turtleneck every day. She said, "I'm spending so much time at my company, I'm sleeping there, it's all I eat, breathe, and I'm not going to want to spend any extra time on my clothing." And this outfit was part of a larger charisma and eccentricity that allowed Elizabeth Holmes to accrue a lot of power in Silicon Valley. She was able to convince many powerful men to join her board, like Henry Kissinger and General Mattis. Rupert Murdoch put, I think, $150 million into the company. And she did this without ever really showing anyone the proprietary technology she had promised.
What about those who say, that's not enough blood to do all the tests that need to be done?
To me, that's a sign that you've actually done something that is transformative.
The problems at the company were closer to a long con than just simple corporate malfeasance. And in the end, I think it maybe all comes back to the black turtleneck. The black turtleneck is a garment that is also a long con. It is able to conceal, and at the same time, it's very attention-grabbing. But it's the kind of attention that you can control. You can hide out inside a turtleneck. It covers a lot of your body. But it also pulls focus to your face. It sculpts your torso into a kind of bust so that your facial expressions are sitting on a pedestal that is your body. When Steve Jobs started wearing the black turtleneck, it stood out in Silicon Valley because a dominant look, especially among tech entrepreneurs there, is something I like to call the young Zuckerberg, which is something like a zip-up hoodie and cargo pants that tends to convey, I'm too busy disrupting the world to care about what I'm wearing. But that's really changing. These days, tech executives don't necessarily want to look like 19-year-old Zuckerberg, but they also don't want to look like Wall Street bankers. So they go to a stylist who specializes in Silicon Valley, someone like Victoria Hitchcock, who's based in San Francisco and is quite successful at dressing tech entrepreneurs.
A guy that I worked with, Gaff Arama, scientist in biotech, shows up to meet with a well-known designer that I've set up a meeting for because we're redoing his entire wardrobe. And we meet at a nice restaurant in downtown San Francisco, and he is wearing thongs, so rubber thongs. It's the summertime, I'll give you that.
Wait, what, rubber thongs? Oh, flip-flops.
Flip-flops.
I thought you meant like thong underwear. That feels very downtown San Francisco. But, okay, so...
So he's got the flip-flops.
He's got his flip-flops on, okay.
That are worn out, like you can't believe.
Just like gross old flip-flops.
Right. Jeans that are about high waters, meaning about 3 inches higher than they should be. Flood pants.
What a look.
Right? And a t-shirt that has moth holes in it. And I have to introduce him to someone who has a reputation.
Do you think he was trying to prank you?
And I wish. No.
Did you eventually get him out of the flip-flops?
I got him out of it all.
I bet he never showed up in flip-flops again.
No, and he's one of my favorite clients.
So walk me through this. Let's pretend I'm a tech CEO and I have a startup that's just gotten my first like big angel round of investment.
Great. Happens all the time.
Yeah.
So we assess, right? And in the assessment, we figure out what their issues are. Then we create a plan.
Do you go shopping with people or do you sort of pull pieces for them or how does that work?
Typically, I'll do a video Skype inside their homes with them so we get a feel for their existing wardrobe. I give them homework to do beforehand. If you're going to be embarrassed to show this, get rid of it before we Skype. And then I identify bad patterns like all black and I figure out why they've focused on those selections. I want them to know how to do the aesthetic on their own, and that's really cool.
So you're sort of teaching people how to figure out what style is so that if they were to go into a store, they could buy it for themselves.
You go find the black leather jacket. It should be this way and that way. I define the parameters, and I love that.
I find it deeply hilarious that you advise some of the people that are so running the tech industry, and they're texting you about which leather jacket to buy.
Because you're in your 40s or 50s, and you're sitting next to the 20-year-olds?
How do you help somebody in their 40s look cool? Like,
oh, easy. You got to make sure the polos are form-fitting, and then it's usually narrowing the pant and not dealing with pleats.
It seems like a lot of the fashion in the Valley is about optimization. I mean, there's that explosion of wearing Allbirds shoes or sustainable fabrics, but it's sort of about, like, optimizing your wardrobe, right?
Right, and the lifestyle. They're embracing it. They really want to look as smart as they are because they're very smart, right? And now we see a younger group, more of an interest in the image because social media tells a story now. And so you have leaders of these companies in the Bay Area that are stepping up their game. You know, when you walk into Apple, everything's intentional in there. Streamlined, the store's bright, clean, organized. Everything has a plan. And now I'm finding that some of these people are catching on because they're the innovators behind concepts like Apple's showroom.
Yeah.
Right? And so they get it. They're like, okay, image is huge. It's huge.
Yeah, they know that it's big in how the iPhone looks, but, you know. I mean, and that's what I think was also one of the most ingenious things Steve Jobs did was with that black turtleneck. He immediately made himself into an iconic image himself.
Right. And he had a fabulous aesthetic.
Yeah.
You may like how he looked now, you may not, but he was a trendsetter. I used to get calls from people early on saying, I'm going to a TED conference. I might be sitting right next to him. What can I wear that's not exactly like him, but really what they wanted was exactly like him?
Everybody wanted to wear the black turtleneck.
Right. Yeah. Where did he get his jeans? You know, what do I do about this? How can I kind of fit in? Because I'm coming from Colorado.
Yeah. So I've been recently fascinated by the story of Elizabeth Holmes, the CEO of the now defunct company Theranos, because I've been so fascinated by her uniform. Just how it functioned and why maybe she chose to wear that other than direct homage to Steve Jobs.
I think it sends out a wonderful professional message pulled together. Mm-hmm. I think it's an easy go-to in the Bay Area because it was warm. And, you know, because of the climate in the Valley, it's chilly 3/4 of the year. So I think it was a practical thing, but I think it exudes confidence and professionalism.
Well, but also there's a world in which the turtleneck is kind of like a cover-up, right? It's like a very masking garment.
Well, good point. It is, and it's unfortunate, but a lot of women hide under their turtlenecks.
Yeah.
I think that's sometimes because of a lack of confidence. And so I like a little bit more authenticity.
Yeah.
The person, so I like to see their shoulders or their wrists. And I love turtlenecks when they're sleeveless.
I mean, I also wanted to ask you about speaking to this idea of how to dress when you have a lot of money, as many people in these big companies do, but you don't want to necessarily transmit that. I think what's really interesting about the style in the Valley is that it's kind of about looking intentionally relaxed and under the radar a little more.
Oh, several layers under.
Really?
Yeah. There's a clash sometimes between women wanting to be considered professional and intellectual. And for a long time, they've had to even downplay some of their feminine features. And I think now they're embracing it more, and I help them and empower them to be who they are, not to try and mask it, but embrace it and show it in a respectful way.
Well, and maybe that's my last question for you, which is why does image matter in business and particularly in the tech sphere? Because isn't it all about the ideas? Like, if you have a good idea, you should go far. Does it matter what you look like?
Well, because these people are working on the technology, the marketing, the business, the sales part of image, creating their branding, So I have Facebook, I have Uber, I have Microsoft, I have Apple. So internally, why would you not start caring about how you look? I mean, if you didn't learn it and never was important, it's all around you now. It's through osmosis.
Yeah.
You better pick it up.
Victoria Hitchcock is a personal style expert who works in Silicon Valley. And she spoke with The New Yorker's Rachel Syme, who writes for us about fashion and other subjects. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Helen Rosner is a food correspondent for the New Yorker, and she interprets that beat pretty broadly. She's as likely to write about the ethics of reviewing or the Me Too issues plaguing restaurant kitchens as she is the perfect recipe for rhubarb. So she had a lot to talk about recently with the Los Angeles chef Nikki Nakayama, who's been featured on the Netflix show Chef's Table, and whose restaurant has been called one of the very best in America. Here's Helen.
Not long ago, I had one of the best meals that I've ever had. It was at a restaurant called Ennaka in Los Angeles, and the kind of food that they serve there is called kaiseki. Kaiseki is a type of Japanese cuisine that you might not be familiar with. It's not that common outside of Japan. It's an incredibly formal, ritualized, elaborate meal that unfolds over the course of hours. There are dozens of courses. The chef at Ennaka in Los Angeles is a woman named Nikki Nakayama. I visited her in the kitchen a few days after I'd had my meal at Ennaka, and when I showed up, she gave me a tour.
And then this is our dish pit area, but trust us, it's a lot more organized when we have service. There's just a lot going on because we have so many dishes. It's like incredible. We had to build a shed outside just to house those dishes. That's why we love our dishwasher. Clemente's been with us for 3 years. I feel very fortunate that people want to like hang out with us and stay. Even though we want to kill each other sometimes, it's very normal.
Nakayama was born in LA, and she grew up there. Her parents are Japanese immigrants who owned a seafood distribution company, so she spent her time as a kid working in the warehouse or hanging out in the office. She figured she was going to become a musician, maybe a pop star, but she ended up spending 3 years studying traditional Japanese cooking in Japan. And in 2011, the culmination of all of that training and running a couple of other restaurants in L.A., she opened Ennaka.
And then this is my work area. I work here.
The kitchen at Ennaka is the first one that Nakayama has been able to build from the ground up. She designed it to suit herself. She's 5'1", and so everything is at counter height or lower. She has notes pasted up by her workstation and near the pass, reminding everyone how to feel, what the mood is, what Ennaka is all about.
But one of the most important notes that I had was actually stuck outside the door, because I felt that this is a very sacred space for me. And I mean, we've all been in kitchens where the environment hasn't always been a friendly one or hasn't been like very conducive to, you know, good things. So I had a note outside that said, good things start now. So basically when you walk in, it's like a reminder to tell yourself that leave all your shit outside. Don't bring it in. Don't bring it in. But that's since fallen off, but generally everybody gets the idea.
When Nakayama talks about these unfriendly environments, I think part of what she's referring to is high-end kitchens in general. Those spaces tend to be pretty bro-y. Almost all of the chefs that are running those kitchens are men. And within the already pretty sexist high-end restaurant world, high-end Japanese cuisine is an area that remains particularly closed to female chefs. Nakayama's response to this is to staff her kitchen almost entirely with women. And that includes her right hand in the kitchen and at everything else, her sous chef, Carol Ida.
I am the sous chef here at Ennaka.
My partner and wife?
Yes.
Don't forget that part.
You're not just the sous chef. You're important in a lot of ways. Oh, and you have the most beautiful Romanesco.
We don't use a lot of Romanesco in Japanese food, but I'm sure we'll figure out a way.
Yeah.
Our first and, like, our go-to thing is, okay, let's just use the standard Japanese method to cook it and see what happens. And if all else fails, we just tempura everything.
Kaiseki is incredibly complex and very ritualized. Chefs train for years, sometimes decades, to become kaiseki masters. The difficulty for someone like Nakayama, who's trying to make kaiseki in California, is that the cuisine developed in Japan. It's a meal that reflects Japanese seasons, Japanese terrain. So to try to translate it to California can be complicated.
I think authentic kaiseki can only exist in Japan. Even for us, we've tried to plant certain plants that are native to Japan in this environment, and it doesn't work. Like, we've tried to put moss in that window behind you, and it doesn't survive because the environment doesn't allow for it to be. It's not humid enough. I don't like to call ourselves traditional kaiseki in any way, but I think our heart and our motive and our ideas about it feel very genuine and authentic to us and who we are. Because I think we're combining a lot of our knowledge of what Japanese cuisine is and also our personal experience of Japanese food and the things we know about it, and combining that with our upbringing in America, it's hard to pretend that we don't have one or the other. So the most authentic representation of who we are is to sort of blend a little bit of both.
So when you say we, you're talking about yourself and Carol?
Yes. Yes.
So when you opened in Naka, Carol wasn't in the picture. Did you guys know each other then?
No.
But then you met and started dating, and then you decided to work together?
Yes. And it all happened sort of by chance, and it was a little bit crazy because I'd lost my sous chef that I'd been working with for 9 years. And then she's like, well, I know dashi, and I know Japanese cuisine. Maybe I can come and help you just, you know, do some of the basic things that are really important. And my initial reaction was like, no, you're going to see what a mess I am and how crazy it can be behind there.
So everything is all together.
Yes.
You and Carol have, you were on the Out 100. You've sort of appeared together as a couple, and you're often described in the media as, you know, like a lesbian chef couple, mm-hmm. Carol Ida and Nikki Nakayama. Do you think that that's an important part of your identity as chefs or Naka's identity as a restaurant?
I didn't want that to be out there because I felt that it's already hard enough to be a female chef, to be judged for so many things. And another level of judgment is not what I want people to focus on when they're coming to eat. I want them just to think about the food and what we're creating. But as time has gone by, I realize and recognize that it's important to sort of put a voice out there to sort of encourage more support and more acceptance. I don't necessarily think that it's very important to tie us to that identity, but I understand how if we are positive about it, it's a good thing.
How has it been difficult to be a female chef?
Sometimes one can't help but wonder how serious people are taking you. There are times in the kitchen where I was like, if I was a man, they would never question me about this. But I don't know if that's true or not. I really, really don't. I don't know because I've never been a man. And I don't know what the opposite reaction would be. But sometimes it's easy to sort of fall back on that just to make yourself feel better. But overall, I feel that I've been very fortunate with Ennaka and that it's not an issue anymore. It used to be an issue with the other restaurants that I have, but for here, no.
You've told the story a couple of times of being at your sushi restaurant, was it? And what was it that a man came in and realized that he was going to be served by a woman and got up and left?
Basically, when he walked in, there was a couple of them, and then they walked in and they saw us and then just turned around and left. And I understood that, oh, he probably thought we weren't a serious restaurant, or, oh, this is not a good restaurant. So they just sort of didn't even try.
Sushi seems to be a uniquely sexist culture, even within the already difficult universe of fine dining. Sushi is really still the realm of men.
That is very true. I think for men in Japan, to have a woman in the kitchen is a distraction for them. And there's this constant belief that women have certain roles that we need to play, and when we're not doing that, we're being rebellious to structure. And rebellion to structure is like a number one no-no in Japan.
So all of your diners here at Annaka know who you are, right? You're pretty well known now. You've been on TV, you've been on a lot of magazine stories. Why do you still cook with the screen closed in front of the kitchen?
I cook with the screen closed because, well, overall, I do enjoy to be the ability to completely focus on the work. And I feel that it's a lot better for the environment to not have it be open kitchen. It's very intimate, and the industrial feeling of the kitchen is very overwhelming and not conducive to a nice, relaxing feeling. But most of all, I want people to come here and think about the food and not think about who's cooking.
So how has Annaka changed since you were on Chef's Table? So what happened?
So the first day Chef's Table came out, we were still taking reservations that were like where the phone was being forwarded to my cell phone. And I remember that it got really hot and we had to turn it off. And then Carol and I just sat there and stared at it for a bit. And we're like, what are we going to do? She's like, this cannot happen. We've got to figure out a plan. And I was like, who's going to take all those messages? I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean, we were booking up maybe like a week ahead, or at least every day we had customers in a good stable amount. But after Chef's Table came out, we became like a restaurant that was booking out 3 months in advance. But seriously, when that happened, Kara and I were like, we need to have a meeting with our staff because expectation levels are going to be really, really high, and we need to make sure that people come in don't get disappointed. So that was the first thing on our mind. It's like, let's not piss anybody off.
Nikki Nakayama, the chef at Annaka, speaking with Helen Rosner of The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us, and please join us next time for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nixon, Stephen Valentino, with help from Mike Dodge Weisskopf, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.